Welcome to Rights Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr. Among my books, I'm also the author of Defend Your Condo and Homeowner Rights and publisher of the first Homeowner's Defense Kit. For books on home and hearth, please visit my website at starpublications.com. That's star with two R's and publications with an S, starpublications.com. The Homeowner's Defense Kit Trilogy, which includes my book, is the first link on the left. We also offer homeowner rights, natural health, and empowerment counseling. Our guest today is Dr. Tony Amoruso, skin cancer and melanoma treatment diagnostician, skin cancer melanoma surgeon, and MOHS, M-O-H-S, specialist. That's micrographic surgery. He's also one of the few skincare specialists in the nation who's willing to undertake personal teleconsultations. Dr. Amoruso specializes in dermatological skin cancer surgery and, as I said, MOHS micrographic surgery. He's performed over 30,000 MOHS procedures with special interest in compounding and formulating dermatological topical medications. He's currently laboratory director of multiple MOHS facilities in Central Florida, where he serves as the supervising physician of physician assistants and nurse practitioners. He's also certified by the American Board of Dermatology and licensed in both Florida and California. Patients throughout the globe request his assistance, including leading Hollywood celebrities. Our topic today is a very important one in light of the news concerning melanoma, and that is dangerous yet curable signs of melanoma and other skin cancers. How to prevent melanoma and age spots. Where, when, and how to apply sunscreen products. What you absolutely must know. Welcome, Dr. Amoruso.
Oh, good afternoon, Dr. Joyce.
It's so good to have you.
It's a pleasure.
Great. Well, let's begin perhaps by explaining to our audience, what is MOHS micrographic surgery?
MOHS micrographic surgery was instituted about 60 years ago by a Dr. Frederick MOHS at the University of Wisconsin. He developed initially a process called chemosurgery, which is not very often done anymore, but the idea is this is a painstaking multiple-day process. Then this has been modified down to the cryo or cold surgery aspect that I use, where specimens are actually taken from patients, analyzed in a precision fashion, stained and looked under the microscope without having to send them out to a hospital or send the slides away to be analyzed by someone else. And we can give the patient a high degree of confidence that the cancer is going to be gone and removed forever when they leave the office. But this process affords about a 99.5% perpetual cure rate.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's 10 times better than if you just try to eyeball the actual place and remove it, because I see countless people over the years come in stating, well, they took it out and sewed it up, and they call me back a week later and said, you have to come back in again. So that's a lot of anxiety that we can avoid most of the time.
Now, I want to come back to that, but before I do, can you explain what is melanoma, and can it happen if you live, for example, in a cave? Are you protected if you're in an enclosed environment most of your life?
Well, benign melanoma is a neoplastic, or that means a change in the cell structure in the DNA that becomes a malignant tumor resulting initially from color cells or melanocytes in the epidermis. And melanomas vary in their rate of aggression, but they're quite often diagnosed, fortunately, in an early state where they can be most likely cured. The melanoma's increased incidence is due to sunlight exposure. The idea that this is more common if you stood at the equator than if you're at the North Pole with the incident light exposure. And most of the areas are sun-exposed areas. However, I do see a lot of areas on the back where there's not a lot of sun exposure.
And
however,
how do you explain that?
Well, sometimes what happens is that people, when they're younger especially, where this has gotten a lot of press, is where you're younger and you get multiple burns, especially with blistering. The incidence, be it it happens on your back frequently when you're in a bathing suit and that. Later on in life, this takes its toll on the total accumulation process of light exposure. Therefore, it can deteriorate with the melanoma, even though you're really not getting that much sunlight. And there's also a possibility of sunlight can filter through clothing. And there's actually some sun-filtering clothing available, but it's not very elegant. And yet, the vast majority of these are in more sun-exposed areas. The idea of living in a cave would preclude the majority of melanomas. However, there's areas in the groin that happen in both sexes on mucous membranes, be it in the mouth and in other body openings, that can have the melanoma arise without, assumedly, any sun exposure. But these can be very aggressive. They can happen in the bottom of the sole of a foot. So it doesn't always have to be sun exposure, but when you look at the cases and you look at plotting back where they were, the overwhelming majority are in areas that sunlight is exposed. So you could go on the idea, if you lived in a cave or you lived underground, your chances of developing melanoma are very slim.
But if you had that sun exposure when you were very young and then you stopped, let's say by the time you reach 25 or you stopped, or even 30, and now the person is 60 or 65, are their chances much higher of not having melanoma if they stopped, or does it really make no difference? Once they had that exposure, it's done.
Well, I believe that the problem is that people will perpetuate the exposure with the sun, people have this foregone conclusion that sunlight is one of their constitutional rights and they have to get it. So yet there's a critical amount that your skin is going to take as far as how much incident light and how much light exposure before it deteriorates. So if you had 99% of your body's allowed amount of sunlight exposure when you're young and you get burned, it doesn't take very much in increments to when you hit 25. It's going to happen. However, if you have only reached 50% of your threshold, then you have a much better chance without any more sun exposure than a person who has never gotten burned as a child, but they might accumulate a lot of sun damage between ages 25 and 40. And actually, I see that quite frequently. So this is something where there's relative amounts of just how much people will have reactions to the sun in a certain area over a certain number of years. And when you hit that quantum, that's when you run into problems.
But you said something very, very interesting here, and that is that there's a certain amount your body can take. Now, how is that registered? How is it quantified? How has the profession really examined that and determined
it? Well, actually, there's a lot of excellent investigational people that do all kinds of studies like this in various journals, and I am really not privy as to exactly what might be being researched at the present time. This is a, should we say, a retrospective analysis on my part over 35 years of dealing with this, is that people say, well, can I get another place right next to this? And if you look at it, that your body is going to, everybody just cannot tolerate the same amount of sunlight. It varies. And I believe that when your body hits its switch point, in other words, it's like a thermometer, it reaches a certain level, it's going to, you know, sound an alarm. So this isn't something written in stone as far as dermatological practice per se with everyone. But I do think anecdotally with this that you can, this is a reasonable thing to where your mine or someone else's skin are going to do different things under the same amount of light exposure. And if you add it all up with varying amounts, with the different intensities over the function of time, your body will hit a point to where a lot of patients come in and said, you know, I'm 50 years old, never had a problem, and now I've gotten all these places in the last year. I run into that a lot with people, where they have fine skin, and then they hit 45, 50, 55, and they get a lot of precancers and skin cancers. And yet somebody else will have the same amount of exposure with the same pigment, blue eyes, maybe, or brown eyes, skin color, olive, fair. They can have a lot of things and never have a problem ever. So there
never.
Is variance in individuality.
Huh. So they can look almost identical. Could they even be in the same family with roughly the same habits, and one has a real problem early on and the other one doesn't?
That's true. And yet there are rare genetic diseases in dermatology whereby multiple siblings could have the same problem where they can't go out in the sun ever, and or there's things of that nature. But for the most part, with the population in general, that I think it's a reasonable thing to observe, and we try to explain to patients, you know, it's something that they can understand pretty much about versus some erudite, you know, finding that you find in a obscure journal which has a lot of importance, but to people it doesn't make any difference. You have to put things in terms people understand and will accept.
You mentioned clothing. I used to purchase a good deal of it. It wasn't really unattractive, not terribly attractive, but not awful. However, of course you're washing it like all other clothing, and my question becomes, and was at the time, doesn't this lose its efficiency? Clothes that are supposedly filled with some kind of sunscreen material.
Well, they haven't. The problem is getting those types of fabrics to be economical, you know, different colors that will fulfill the same purpose, and yet the fabric feel soft and elegant. And this is where you'll never be able to get like a silk fabric that would feel like silk. However, if wearing just even a black shirt, you know, a cotton Oxford black shirt, is really not always going to protect you that much because you're going to absorb a lot of heat in a black fabric. Or people think if you wear white, it'll reflect, and that's possible. But if you are at a place like in Miami, it gets a tremendous amount of sunlight exposure. You go around long enough, and you're going to get some light eruptions happening of various etiologies or causes in areas where the sun doesn't hit. And that's why they sell apparel that is UV filtering, but at least I've very rarely ever had patients buy them. Maybe they don't like the price of it either. But
the price is very high. It's really quite high.
They don't want to do it. And if they're going to blow a whole lot of money on an outfit, they're not going to buy a sunscreen outfit.
No, and it's really, as you said, not very fashionable. Quite comfortable, I must say. The fabric is light and airy and comfortable, but it doesn't give you the feeling that you have when you buy normal clothes. But that brings me to the question of colors. What colors should you be wearing? I wear a lot of black, a lot of white, and now from what you said, they're both bad.
Well, it's so much that in other words, the individual, it's their ability to wear black and white will vary with another person's ability to wear a black or a white. Those are just two extremes of the spectrum. But it comes down to be clothing or not, that the exposure to sunlight, the best sunscreen is no sunscreen to filter the damaging rays out. Yet if you use caution, and I think, though, that lighter colors frequently are better because of the heat aspect of in this climate that we live in down in Florida, that they're better for the type of climate that we have. However, it's a matter to, when you wear them, that during the peak of the sun exposure time between like 10 and 3 o'clock, the idea is that you're going to basically get a lot of heat from the sun along with the ultraviolet radiation. So this is something that is an enigma that has haunted myself and other dermatologists for years, but I really have not run across many dermatologists in different parts of the country who find it worthwhile to push the special clothing on patients. you know, it's like the pioneers. They, when you look at pictures of the covered wagons, the women all had bonnets, and they all had long-sleeved outfits on to their cuffs, and they wore dresses that hit the ground. And it might have been the fashion then, but actually it had a utilitarian purpose to protect them from sunlight.
You think they knew it?
Pardon me?
Did they know it? Do you have any records or stories or anecdotes to suggest that part of what was going on at that time was a desire to protect the skin because they were always exposed, they were always outside?
I don't have any specific reference to that, but if you look at this, people, when they're, you know, exposed to the elements, they're going through blazing sun, they're going across deserts, why do you think they would wear long sleeves? I think people got burned, and they figure if they put a fabric, they'll not get burned as bad.
What if you wear layers? What if you wear layer over layer? Will that further protect you? And can you amplify just a little bit what you said about heat? Why would heat be dangerous?
The heat itself that you absorb can sometimes ignite certain things we call photodermatoses or light eruptions, which are not necessarily at all associated with skin cancer, but they can cause an igniting of drug reactions or types of eruptions on the skin that are of unknown cause. But heat and light as two variables can be contributory to multiple light-induced skin problems. But everything doesn't exist in the sense of a skin cancer. But there's a lot of persistent problems, like, as an example, if a woman has a problem such as systemic lupus, that problem can worsen with sunlight exposure. And it can even worsen more. Sometimes I've seen this happen where they can get the heat and the sun ignites the skin lesions of that disease. So this is not a cancer, but it's a serious illness that could be exacerbated by, most important, light, but also I think the combination of light and heat. And yet with the generation of skin cancers, it's not as related as some other processes, but I do think that heat does have a certain factor. Yet I've been in parts of the country where the sunlight intensity is not as much as we have here. And that's the idea, because we're closer to the sun than someone who lives in Washington State. But I do think that the ultraviolet light is the overall number one criminal involved with this. But I do think that the heat aspect generated does have a difference in how it does and how this things evolve.
If you wear sunscreen and you reapply it during the day, Is this going to help protect you if you had all those years of lack of protection or no protection? Again, starting in the 40s or 50s, you begin to apply sunscreen. Is it too late?
I never think it's too late to apply the sunscreen, because this is like I was saying, this is my view of the light exposure situation entirely, is that when you can arrest the amount of light coming into your body at any time during your life, it will halt or at least slow down the rate at which you're going to have the deterioration in the skin to where it is going to rebel and come back and bite you for, you know, the idea of how much light exposure. So if you can stop at a certain time the light exposure, this is not like the perpetual motion machine. I mean, you can arrest, not necessarily reverse, but arrest the development of more sun damage, therefore the sun skin cancer from coming out. So I don't believe it's ever too late to do that. And I think that it's a good practice to do that.
What about an umbrella? Now, again, I am in Miami, in the greater Miami area, but much before I arrived here, I was never in a lot of sun or hot sun without a sun umbrella, or a regular umbrella posing as a sun umbrella.
Right.
Is it really effective?
Oh, anything that's going to either deflect and or reduce the amount of light coming down at you is extremely important. The problem is getting people to comply with that. In other words, that's why ladies, you know, they would always look in the old fashions at the turn of the century. They'd have their long gowns and they'd have their parasols and, you know, or they'd have some covering on their head. And a lot of them are twirling little umbrellas behind them. And there was a purpose to shade them from the sun. But nowadays, it would be kind of a different thing to see everybody in Miami walking down the street with an umbrella, but it would actually be a reasonable adjunct and or addition to the things you're doing to try to avoid the total amount of light exposure that you're getting.
So, I get questions like, well, is it going to rain today? Are you worried about rain? And I said, I'm worried about sun rain. And there's always someone who's going to remark on my umbrella when there's absolutely not a cloud in the sky. But I don't care.
That's right, because those are the people that look like a lizard at age 40. I see variances all the time and with age and everything. And the common denominator, with people is how much sun have you had for your whole life? Well, when I was a kid, I had a whole lot, and then I moved to, but then I lived in Chicago. And then I moved here at age 60 to Florida, and 2 years later I got skin cancer. So the people will say it's all Florida's fault, but it actually was the whole lifetime's fault of the exposure to the sun.
If you should use, as I do, a sun umbrella, sometimes I find them, and they say sun umbrella on them, but most of the time I can't find them other than ordering umbrellas that cost $50 because they say that they're sun umbrellas. Is there really a difference in the fabric, and would it hold up over time, or after a few months, is the sun umbrella the same as any other umbrella?
Well, to me, fabrics you want to be nice and soft, durable, but flexible in an umbrella type of thing. Whether nylon and acetates and those things will block sunlight, but one of the best things would be, but I don't know if it would be reasonable to incorporate into an umbrella, would be boat sail fabric, where very, very good umbrellas on your patio have this boat sail, where the stuff they actually use to make the sails for sailboats, and this material is designed to deflect light, to be durable, yet to, of course, pick up wind and propel the boat, but it's something where light doesn't get through at all. And that's an ideal fabric. The difficulty is it's heavy to put inside an umbrella. And I've seen people make umbrellas out of the same film coat that they put on windows to tint them and things of that nature. So incorporating all these technical things is the hard part with an umbrella. But if someone could come out with a better version of it that could be accepted as far as reasonable in fashion elegance, it would be a good thing to use. It's just to try to get people to use it.
The ones that exist are two forms. One is a kind of cotton material, and based on what you say, and light colors, and based on what you're saying, that probably isn't doing enough of a job, because what you just stated is that it should be heavy enough to deflect the light. And the second fabric is just looks like any other umbrella, but it's called a sun umbrella. Now, I don't know if they put something extra in it, but it feels and looks for all practical purposes like any other umbrella.
So they try to put some of these reflective, like mylar, or some type of a thin plastic that would supposedly reflect light or take a lot of the filtering down and reduce a lot of the incident long-wave ultraviolet A light, which can penetrate the skin. So that's the idea with some of those, but if you look at an expensive umbrella on a patio and you look at a real cheap one, you can actually see through a lot of the cheap ones. There's minute little areas in the fabric because it's a very inexpensive, poorly made fabric.
So the key issue is not being able to see through it. But in that regard, would a normal umbrella be at least some protection?
Oh, yeah, it would. It's just the idea of using it. So, it's up to yourself. If you feel comfortable and you just want to put an umbrella up and you're going down the street, it's a free country, and it's going to protect you more than someone who doesn't have it.
Good. Now, can you please explain to our listeners the different types of skin cancer and melanoma?
Oh, there's basically the skin cancers that I run into in dermatologists throughout the world. The most common one is a basal cell carcinoma. And the basal cell carcinoma is the most common skin cancer. Actually, it's the most common cancer in the world. But fortunately, it's the most curable. It's almost universally 100% curable, and especially if it's not a large area. Squamous cell carcinomas are potentially more aggressive. They can spread to other parts of the body, where basal cell carcinomas, extremely rare to do that. They usually destroy skin locally. But with squamous cell carcinomas in older men on the ear and on the lips, they're very notorious for spreading into salivary glands and lymph nodes. It does take a long time of neglect, though, to have this happen.
But Why the ear?
The ear and the lips are areas where, especially the lips, they can have a tendency to recur more often, and they can become aggressive. That's why the surgery to those areas has to occasionally be radical to take the area out. However, this is, of course, the spread to important structures. Fortunately, it doesn't happen that often, but it is theoretically possible. As far as somebody having one on their leg and they wind up getting spread to the lungs, it's possible, but I've never seen it in my whole life before. Yet these two comprise the vast majority, but the one that's picking up momentum with more and more sun exposure, and I'm not even bringing in the whole ozone layer thing, over the years has been malignant melanoma, where malignant melanoma, in some studies, and it's probably been changed and altered, but the conservative estimate was 1 in 75 people are going to get a melanoma in their lifetime. That's a universal incidence, being that Miami would get, of course, possibly a greater proportion of people melanoma exposed with the exposure rather than somebody in Fargo, North Dakota. Yet the melanomas they're becoming more commonly diagnosed because doctors are more vigilant, and you try to basically educate the public about this is a serious problem. And these three are the ones that are the vast majority of malignancies. There's a large number of other malignancies of the skin that just don't occur that often, and it would be, in this discussion, would be of absolutely no value to the average person who is concerned about skin cancer.
So a mole that is not malignant is called benign, and
right.
By definition, melanoma is a malignancy.
Right. In pathology, malignant is the same as something that can metastasize. So if something is malignant, it has the ability to spread. And metastasize means spread away from the primary site. So these things, but in other words, you don't have a benign melanoma, because the melanoma, by definition, is malignant and it can be metastatic.
And what should you be looking for? What are some of the clear signs that you might have a problem in what you thought was a benign mole?
When patients, they want to know, well, what do I look for? What you want to do is, first of all, not make the patient neurotic on everything that's a little brown bump. They'll become preoccupied with this. But what you try to do is the significance is a lot of the areas of moles that were there before, which if you measured them, they'd be approximating the size of a pencil eraser, a little smaller. And things that, if you use that as a reference point, this is not always the case, but that is a reference point, you would want someone to determine, has it spread laterally or side to side? More importantly, has it gotten larger up and down? That's called the vertical phase. And if you had an area that was flat and now it's got a lump in it, you want to biopsy that place. You look for irregular pigment where it's dark in one corner and tan in the other corner. Those are indicators frequently of a melanomatous change. If someone says, I have this mole, and they'll point to one specific place, that mole itches a lot, then that would be an indicator to remove it. If you have an area that bleeds without you messing with it, or erodes like an ulceration on the top, then those are indicators that you want to biopsy those also. The change of color from light to dark is something that is really hard for people to actually notice on themselves unless somebody else has been looking at them. And since melanomas can exist in a clear or a reddish phase, everything isn't always dark. But I do believe that the ideas of starting with that reference point of a pencil eraser and the up and down growth of something or a new one that just popped out and was never there before, they're important things to just check and get that area biopsied and tested.
And when we talked about this, and we've talked about it frequently, about getting something biopsied? Well, I've explained that those millions and millions of Americans who don't have health insurance face a difficult problem here. A, they don't have perhaps a primary care physician, certainly not a dermatologist if they're not actively seeing doctors along the way. And now they're being told you should have this checked, and they really don't know where to begin, who to see, and what to do. If you walk into a dermatologist, for example, and he says, well, that ought to be biopsy. But what if he says not only that, but that, but that, and that, and that? Now, of course, you're facing, what, a $1,000 bill for that one visit? And I think people are worried about the money as well.
Well, there's people who have risk factors. Where, in other words, there's some people who have a large number of irregular moles. And those people need to be examined multiple times during the year. But the average John Q. citizen type of person, I think that if they had a total body skin exam once a year is more than adequate in order to establish a baseline and then also to monitor changes, because these things frequently do not deteriorate instantaneously. And I think that it's reasonable because you can't examine everybody every month. And then frequently what happens is that, especially with men, that their wives find odd-looking moles. And then they'll say, you better get that checked. I hear this all the time. Get that checked. So most men, of course, don't want to do it, but to shut the wife up, they'll go do it. And unfortunately, I mean, for him, it's a good fortune that we can biopsy it, and lo and behold, there's a melanoma there. Of course, he has to listen to his wife say how she saved his life forever. But the idea that this is something where a lot of stuff is actually spouses can check each other, too, and check. I tell people, if your wife sees a place that she's worried about, tell her to take one of those laundry markers or something, draw a circle with an arrow, come here. And I'll biopsy it. That's reasonable to do. But myself, I'm against doing tons of biopsies. It's expensive, and someone has holes in them. And a lot of times, what you're going to find does not justify the amount of damage that you've done. So you've got to be able to tell a patient, this is why we did such and such. And we found, of course, if you biopsy 20 places and one's a melanoma, you did your job, but fortunately that is not the case very frequently. Yet the cost of doing biopsies, the pathological analysis of these things, is what really makes the cost go up. And that's,
how much
that's
is it? Isn't it roughly at least $100 per biopsy?
I mean, it can be, yes. Then what happens if a good pathologist looks at one of these things and cannot make up their mind as to exactly what kind of a place it is, there are some excellent world-famous people in this country who can send a slide to them and have them give an opinion. Of course, that's an extra expense. So this can definitely crescendo in the cost of just one specimen being examined. And therefore, if you do, and then what happens is when you do too many, it's hard to find the spot again exactly because you have so many spots. And the idea is that you can lose track of what you're doing. So I really, for the most part, don't like to do more than 3 biopsies. But if a patient hits God forbid, a melanoma, but there's also a whole other subject of whether you wanted me to interject that presently, to where there's moles that really have some weird cells, but they're not melanomas, and yet they may have a chance greater of becoming a melanoma than a regular mole. You might find one of those, like an atypical or what we call dysplastic mold. And that's also a very good thing if you find one, because it justified what you did and you could do something relevant to help the patient. But I've seen 10 out of 10 turn out to be nothing. So I myself am not a believer in doing that part. It becomes too much for patients. Besides the cost when they walk out the door, it becomes a lot of money.
Where are you currently located?
Well, I work now with a very large, well-respected dermatology group in Central Florida. And we have multiple locations in Volusia County and Orange County, Seminole County, and also over towards the Tampa direction. And This is something where total body examinations are a very frequent part of either the doctors and the nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants. And I've seen more melanomas between everybody that I keep, of course, supervise and other doctors than I've seen in the previous 30 years. And it's climatic here, but we also have more doctors available to be able to ascertain this thing, because family doctors or, you know, pediatricians, family practitioners, they do a great job. They take care of a lot of different things, but their job is not to know every salient feature of mold, whereby it's expected of someone like myself to be able to determine that. And I think that this is proven out to be a reasonably good system. The problem is, like you said, that I believe that charging people a fortune to come in and tell them there's nothing wrong with them, or to basically run up the expense of doing it by doing multiple biopsies, many of which could theoretically be frivolous, but you never know on any biopsy what's going to happen. That part of it is I don't totally agree with. And I think that there's, you know, you can cut corners to be able to cut the cost, but you can't cut corners in quality for the person. But the cost factor is something that you have to unfortunately take into account more than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
And I want to mention right here that you do, and you are prepared to do even more, you do teleconsultations with clients and patients where they can send you personally a picture of the spot, and you will do a consultation with them by phone after you're reviewing the picture, which has to be, of course, a very high quality, and they can learn more about this at drderm, D-R-D-E-R-M, detective.com, drdermdetective.com, which is your website, and they can also reach you by calling us because you are a member of our Brain Trust, and we offer one-on-one consultations with members of our Brain Trust, so they can reach you through Rights Radio or directly on your website at drdermdetective.com and find a doctor who's willing to talk to them on the phone, which is really amazing. Probably the only one in the United States, but if there are several others will say that you're one of, but I think you're probably the only one.
Well, I do get a pleasure out of helping people. I've seen too much of this type of skin problem over the years, and it's, especially with melanomas, it's something that you have to look at it, that it's reasonable to say that melanoma is universally fatal. If you don't diagnose it and treat it, it'll start on the surface, but you let that go and it can definitely deteriorate and head straight into the body. So if you can even help a person to a small degree by saving their life, so to speak, by doing a biopsy, it's something that's a great service. Frequently, you can tell visually what it is, but you do have to have the tactile response of sometimes touching them and just see how they feel and see if it's raised. But there's multiple factors on that diagnosis, but it's really a vitally important subject, and I think too many people poo-poo it. You know, it's only the skin. What can that do to me? You know, so I believe that that's true in the sense of importance, and the amount of, I believe, cutting down as much damage as you can from any light exposure, period, are two things of, because if you don't have someone observing and analyzing, but you need someone to actually execute a plan to go from there and do something with your mole. How to fix that in the present way with medicine and that, I wish I could answer.
There's a very famous doctor on the web. He's a natural doctor. Actually, he's a dentist who presents himself as a natural doctor, and by now he has tremendous information and background and sells a lot of products. And one of the things that he sells is the idea that you should spend at least 10 to 20 minutes a day in the sun to get vitamin D directly. Is that dangerous?
The amount of vitamin D that's synthesized from sunlight, as far as I understand, is not that great as far as your vitamin D minimal amount that is required. But 10 to 20 minutes in the sun, I don't find any problem with it. Even if you're standing in, you know, Ecuador at the equator, for 10 or 20 minutes isn't going to hurt anybody except those individuals who have these light-sensitive diseases that I mentioned before.
What if you do it every day, though? Every day you spend 20 minutes in the sun. Is that dangerous at the equator?
I really don't think it is. 20 minutes at the peak of any day could make some people pink. But the amount of exposure to the damaging rays, especially the different wavelengths of ultraviolet light, would not be enough unless you're, an albino or a really, really fair-skinned individual. But
it wouldn't be cumulative? I thought that sun damage was cumulative.
Well, that's how I do feel that, but the idea is when you're looking at it, if you basically cover yourself up, wear sunscreen, be aware of, that's your allowance for the day, that I believe that that's reasonable. But you would be surprised on the amount of sun exposure people get driving their car. It comes right through the window glass. It doesn't matter how dark they have it tinted. It'll go right through the window glass, and that adds up during traffic, an hour each day, each way to work. That's a lot of exposure.
The tint doesn't help?
No. Not with
at all?
Not with the damaging rays. It'll keep you from squinting. It'll make it cooler in the car. It looks nice when it's real black windows and stuff, but the idea how much that will filter out the light, the ultraviolet light, and still allow you to look out the window and see, you're going to get light exposure. Especially, I see this commonly, with men especially, the left side of the face gets more places than the right side, when I've looked at it as far as lesions on the ear and on the neck. And if you drive long enough, for enough years, and it comes right through the window glass.
Now, that's another question, because I've been putting, as far back as I can remember, I've been putting little screens on my windows next to the driver's side to block the rays and to block the lights, too much light for me. And I can see through quite fine, but I do have these little screens. Are they of any use?
So you can block the amount of, sun coming in to where it's going to make it comfortable for you to drive. But the perfect block would, unfortunately, keep you from driving because you couldn't look out the window. So as long as you can see out the window and light can come through, you're going to get some, be it minimally filtered, long-wave ultraviolet light, no matter what color it is. And I have my windows are tinted, too, as dark as I can get them. But that is basically to keep the car cooler and to not have you sitting there squinting your eyes all the time. But you're still going to get an accumulation of light. I advocate putting the sunscreen on every day, if you're going to do it at all, to put it on your face and your neck and your ears, so the various directions that light would come through, you do as all you possibly can to reduce the amount of accumulating exposure you're getting.
Is there a good sunscreen and a bad sunscreen? What type of sunscreen should we be using?
Well, it's a matter of taste, in the sense of how a person likes the feel of things. Myself, I like one that's alcohol-based that dries really quickly, be it you could use a 30 to a 50, and they don't have a tendency to, when you sweat, to run and get in your eyes, and they're easy to apply and spread. A lot of ladies don't like drying things, so they want a nice lotion that they can put on as a moisturizer and a sun exposure, a moisturizer just for general use, under their makeup in that respect, and there's lots of these that are expensive, there's lots of them that are inexpensive, but frequently you can buy a good quality product for $10 to $15 a bottle at the most.
I'm always suspect of makeup or moisturizer that claims to be a sunscreen. To my mind, it's either apples or oranges.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, I don't trust anything because the FDA has different standards even on over-the-counter products, that if they tout that this is a makeup with a 250 sunscreen in it, it's considered as a cosmetic. Whereby, if there's a product that comes out, and a lot of the big companies, the ones that we've known for years, and Coppertone, and all these other ones, they're selling this as a sunscreen. So the actual proof or the ability of these things to work to match their claim is a lot harder. So if you buy a makeup product, I'd buy it because you like the makeup, but you still need to use something else to protect yourself from the sun with it. That's why a lot of very, very good sunscreens, now that they're sold as sunscreening lotions, However, they, with the right reputable company in that, those you can rely on because they can function as an under-makeup moisturizer. But one that you would buy, like, from Estee Lauder or Lancome, that touts, I don't believe that stuff. I wouldn't bank on it myself. I wouldn't trust it to protect me.
So it's best to go with the companies that have been providing sunscreen for years and years.
That's how I feel because, they're, first of all, over the time, they have the resources to refine their products. And they also are able to market these at a relatively low price or lower price. And I do think that it's something where there's the name recognition is fine. And you don't have to spend a lot of money on these things.
What about natural versus unnatural, so-called? I've purchased sunscreens that claim to be natural, and quite frankly, I don't think they're providing the protection that I need. I see a difference in the reaction to my skin, sometimes even an allergic reaction, whereas the old traditional standbys give me no reaction whatsoever. Why would
the sunscreening agents, when you look at a very good sunscreen, you'll notice that frequently they'll contain now a product called titanium dioxide, which is a chemical. And then you look at the other things, and there's about 50 chemicals listed. And so to someone who's a purist with the natural, this is, of course, unconscionable. You just can't have all those chemicals. But those chemicals, some of them are biological products that the body makes that are enhanced. Some are completely foreign to the body. And yet if you look at overall of all the people protected, the amount of actual allergic reactions is not as great as people might make it out to be when you look at how many applications are made. With the natural product, there's maybe not all these chemicals, but there are a lot of natural products that are plants and things that can cause an irritation when you put it on, or worse, when you get the exposure to the sun, causes another reaction of its own. So you have to take this in hindsight, that natural doesn't always mean it's going to work. I'm not trying to be a skeptic on everything natural, but I have a jaundiced eye on this because, remember, you can tout whatever you want as a claim when you say it's all natural. So you can state this. That's why these TV ads where they have an all-natural product for weight loss and your money-back guarantee and everything, because they don't have to conform to the FDA. And I think that these things are very relevant. And if you find one that's a natural product that you like and it works for you, that's great, but you can spend less money and get something that's time-proven.
What about sunscreens for babies and children? I often find that those are the best of all.
Well,
I enjoy using them.
But they're put into either nice smelling or nice texture, nice color, ease of application, and some of the chemicals that can actually cause irritation in adults are removed. So they're essentially the same products, but they're just made into a softer, more friendly delivery system. And I think that a lot of people like them, like yourself. Very much so.
I prefer to use the sunscreen for babies than I do the sunscreen for adults. But my question here might be, is there a difference? Because, for example, some are aerosol and some are spray and some are heavy cream, some are liquid. Does it matter which form you use? Are the sprays and the aerosols less effective? In other words, they say, here, you can spray it on all day. Just here, a spray can. But I'm a bit suspect of that.
Well, when you have a spray, though, you're always dealing with a dispersion effect. In other words, you're going to get some of it's going to be intense coming out of the nozzle. But then as anything goes and you wind up with a greater field in front of you, that's going to take away from how much is coming there as opposed to what left the nozzle. So if you use it, I do believe that the sprays can give some protection, but some of them are going to have propellant. Some of them would have an aerosol component. There might be an alcohol or an alcohol derivative in there that's drying. But I really think that if you look at a mom who's got to put medicine on three kids at the beach quickly, the first thing she's going to grab is an aerosol rather than having to rub stuff. So whether or not they're that effective, but their demand is out of expediency, and their demand is, it looks nice and dandy, just spray it on. Now, there are products that are made by companies that sell the same thing in a lotion form. but I that's how I feel about those sprays. Most of the time, the only way to make a spray work to my satisfaction is to take the can and just spray it into your hand like you're spraying shaving cream in there. And then it'll accumulate in a larger amount, and then I could put it on my face. But to spray from a distance and think you're going to get it, if you're at the beach and it's windy, how much is actually getting on their skin?
Right.
You never know.
Correct.
Put it on. It's easy to put it on. There's a lot of waste, but it's easy to put on.
We have about 5 more minutes, and I want to get into the issue of liver spots. What are they, and how can we prevent them? They're quite ugly most of the time, and often on the face. But before we move to that, I simply want to reiterate that you do private teleconsultations. Go to rightsradio.com, send us an email, ask for information, and we'll pass it on to Dr. Amoruso. And I think we've all come to feel quite comfortable in talking with you. I'm sure my audience feels. I know I do. So now, on to liver spots. What do we need to know?
Well, liver spots, you know, people would call them liver spots, and that name, I can honestly not tell you how it got that term. People call them old age spots, but those are these irregular, brownish, flat, non-scaling areas that you'll see most frequently as you get older. You get more of these, but let's just try to pick on some poor 80-year-old person. So you look on their hand, and you look on their arm, and you can see these spots that they can blend or they can be discreet and, you know, well marked off. They're on the, frequently they're more in the top part of your arm because of the way sunlight hits your arm. That's the most common places are on the hands and the arms because they're exposed. Now on the face you can still get the same processes, and this is analogous to freckles and when you're a kid. Now sometimes freckles do go away with time, but these are areas of pigmentation that are dormant in the skin that may not have been there when you were younger, and then these liver spots, quote-unquote, they come out when you get older because your body is hitting that critical amount of ultraviolet light to excite cells to make the color cause the spot on the surface of the skin. And I've seen these things, tons of them, in a 40-year-old, and, of course, with time, therefore, the older you get, the more you might have, but the usage of a sunscreen back, let's say, way back when you're 20 or 30, that sunscreen is going to protect you from accumulating that damage. And the reason I bring this up is that my mother is like 91 years old, and my grandmother, she was 99 when she died, but the idea that they would go to the beach and live at the beach, but they didn't go outside without protecting themselves. And if you don't get any light exposure, my mother hardly has any places. But people half her age have a ton. And that's back to the light exposure and the how much of a total amount your skin's going to take before it does something, even though I would be happier if people got liver spots and gets cancers in those places.
What's the best way to remove them? Fade creams?
Well, a prescription product for bleaching, in theory, you could put it on a spot or two, but it takes weeks and weeks and weeks to give you a marginal success sometimes. But then you're going to wind up invariably, if you rub it on your arm up and down, like a night cream or something, the problem is it's going to hit the normal skin, so you're going to wind up bleaching the areas involved, but then your normal skin is going to get lighter. And if you use those fading creams, if they take the color out and you just keep putting it on, you can irreversibly damage those cells or they may never come back. So that's a problem there. Freezing them with liquid nitrogen is impractical because of the stuff. It's brutal and it's painful and it causes blisters. So if someone in a perfect world has time and a lot of money, you can use certain lasers on them. The difficulty is nobody pays for that to be done, and it takes a lot of time to do it, multiple trips, and it isn't cheap.
But so there's not a lot of solutions for liver spots. The best solution is not to get them.
But exactly. If
you get them...
And the best that you can do is minimize the amount of exposure to the sun you have and to use the clothing as best you can to cover them up, and to use a sunscreen. That's all any human being can do.
So instead of buying lots of different fade creams, save up your money and get them removed through a laser treatment.
Unless somebody comes up with a better mousetrap in the future, the laser is probably the most precise way to get it. But like I said, is that it's a lot of money when you look at the total amount of the arms and that.
Is it a lot of money because it's inflated artificially by the profession, or is it a lot of money because it really costs a lot to do it? Well, couldn't they make it cheaper for people?
Well, for the sake of dermatologists wanting to crucify me, the idea is that the cost of this stuff is basically in buying the machines, which have come down in cost, but they still are expensive. I mean, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars for an office machine. And the maintenance to keep them up, they are a pain in the neck. They're like getting an Italian sports car, but you have to have a live-in Italian mechanic to fix it. So there are companies that are in California, and you're in Florida, and there's nobody but somebody from California come fix it. So it does get expensive on the maintenance, but the actual usage of the product, you don't use up any materials. You're not basically depleting the laser's ability from the crystals they put in there. So on the other side of your question, the profession, of course, I'll admit that everybody wants to get in on the act and, you know, depending where medicine's going, make money with cosmetic procedures. Whether or not it's overinflated, it probably could very well be in certain sectors, but since I basically have evolved from doing that to the more skin cancer thing, I couldn't really tell you exactly what the price is, but it's something where there might be $150 for 20 minutes worth of treatment. But you might have to go back to that area two or three times to get that place to go away. So one unit area that you do in 20 minutes might cost $400 or $500 to actually totally eradicate.
This is very interesting, and unfortunately we're now coming to the end of our hour together. I want to remind our listeners to visit rightsradio.com and star with two R's publications.com, where we have a wonderful selection of books detailing your rights. And I also want to recommend that they visit drdermdetective.com to learn more about our Dr. Tony, who's also a member of our Brain Trust. And I'm very happy to say that this program was sponsored by Macy's. Macy's has a wonderful cafe in the main floor, Macy's Aventura. There's several across the country, but one of the first ones is here and in River City, as I call it, and it's really a wonderful little cafe, and they've come aboard as a sponsor, and we're so happy to have them. That's Macy's Taste Bar. We have a coupon. You can get a 10% discount with that coupon. You can find it at rightsradio.com on our sponsors page. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure, Joyce.
And I really look forward to more interaction with you. We're going to be offering a special report to our Well, we have to close now, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.